Yeah, man. Knives Out from 2001, the magnificent, astonishing Amnesiac. So I want to just recap the logic that politicians were presenting in, including Fauci, especially Fauci. And I've got to find out who the Martin Luther King aspartame guy was. I should know him, but okay. If the state ends the lockdown, the numbers all get better. But if the state has the lockdown and people don't obey the lockdown, the numbers get worse. So this is a political virus. This is a virus that is moralistic. If you obey the law and don't lock down, socially distance, everything's fine. But if there's an imperative to behave yourself and you misbehave in ways that are exactly the same as the people who don't have any rules, then your numbers get worse in adjoining states. And by the way, the first clue that there is not an infectious pandemic is when neighboring states, neighboring zip codes, neighboring countries have different outcomes. Okay, and there's another one, and you know, this is another one that doesn't require you to be Nikola Tesla or Einstein to understand. There are scientific principles which govern the proof of whether something is infectious. And those basically say, the simplest way that I can boil down Koch's postulates, they're called, is that the people who are sick must all have the presumed pathogen, and healthy people must not have it. And so if you have only some of your sick people having the pathogen, i.e. testing positive, which we know all about that, and then 99% of the people who test positive don't have anything wrong with them, you got the wrong thing. This is the fitting the round peg in the round hole and the square peg in the square hole. This is Idiocracy level stuff. Is it making sense? I'll go through that again just in case someone didn't pick that up. Koch's postulates basically is how you deduce whether the thing that you say causes the disease, which is that all the people with the disease are supposed to have it, and all the people who don't have the disease aren't supposed to have it, and then you're not supposed to have a lot of people who have the thing but don't have the disease, because they have the thing and don't have the disease, i.e. they test positive and are not sick, that's the wrong pathogen. It's the wrong so-called cause. And we really need to keep pondering how exactly it is that people can believe this and live with themselves. They can fall for this posturing and still live with themselves and still look at themselves in the mirror. And there's a lot of reasons for this. And one of them is that people have given up so much and have invested so much in their fear that, well, must be true, even if all the evidence points against it. To me, it seems like the message of the medium of the pandemic is to convince people that they are a biohazard. They're trying to convince you you're going to kill people. And because you're going to kill people, you should cover your face. Cover your face. That will prevent you from killing people. And then you can finally feel good about yourself. The will to good, as Alice Bailey said, the will to good is being co-opted. It is being abused. They're taking that impulse that people have to do the right thing. And they're saying, okay, you want to do the right thing? Here's the right thing to do. Wear a shmata. Wear a Harley Davidson bandana. And then you too can pretend that you're walking around in a biosafety 4, BSL 4 containment suit, and are therefore not going to spread or be contaminated with germ warfare, essentially, germ warfare. And by the way, for those who believe that that this may have come out of the Wuhan Virology Institute. I do not believe that it did, and even if it did, the rules would be the same. You would be required to have a full sequence, and you'd be required to meet Koch's postulates, and if so, what a shitty species of germ warfare. Your tax dollars paid for germ warfare where 99% of the people who have it don't get sick. Well, what if we have to wipe out the enemy with this stuff? Well, that's not going to work so good. We're just going to test positive. We're going to give the enemy a case-demic. So it's not germ warfare. That is ridiculous. And I saw Tom Cowan, internet hero. I may see him again tomorrow. I fully anticipate seeing him again tomorrow at an event that I'm going to be at all day tomorrow. And by the way, if you have a hint of what I'm talking about, you live in upstate New York, you think you might want to go to this thing, email me at efc@ericfrancis.com. Oh, wait, no, cell phone's not allowed. I'll leave it out in the car and maybe check periodically. Well, there's really not much we can do about this. But, you know, email me anyway. efc@ericfrancis.com. That's an address that's most easily accessible to me. Anyway, I saw Tom Cowan a couple of months ago at an event, and I said, I walked up to him. He's hard to miss. He's about 6.5 feet tall, so you can see him standing high above the crowd and some of the trees. And he said, I said to him, I think that the reason this was said to be in Wuhan was because they could pin it on the Virology Institute, and it would make it seem real. And he said, right, it's a patsy. Like, wow, I'm so glad you figured that out, and you gave me the word. What's a patsy? Somebody falsely blamed Lee Harvey Oswald. Snipers in 8 positions, all shooting at the president, but we're going to blame the one guy with a bolt-action rifle, which no one can reproduce this thing where you can. Have you ever shot a bolt-action rifle? I mean, it takes a while to slip the thing up, back up, down, and then re-aim. You can't do that with a moving limousine and hit every time, fire 3 shots and hit every time. No. So that's patsy. And even if it came out of the lab, the rules are the same. There must be a full sequence. Koch's postulates must be met. That we must have none of healthy people having the infection, so-called, and all the sick people having the infection, which they don't. Same rules apply. But hey, you know, Wuhan Institute of Virology. Now I'm looking for some notes here. A dialogue I had with someone who was at one time a phenomenal astrologer on the Planet Wave staff, now not doing so well. He's in an assisted living facility, and he was, you know, worried about the virus. And I said, Charlie, are you aware that this virus has not been isolated, has not been purified, has not been sequenced, and it's not living up to the rules, the scientific method of virology, which proves the cause? And he said, well, people are dying of something, and that's what, and so it must be the virus. And this is what most people will say as their final line of defense, that the virus is real. They will say, well, people are dying of something. So I said, you know, my first reply to his, you know, the virus is very real down on the ground. And I said, Charlie, this is in silico. This virus only exists in a computer script. I have invested a significant portion of my life in establishing this. If I had practiced guitar all that time, I would play like Eric Clapton. And he said, he wrote back, very smart, observant guy, but here's what he said. It's people with comorbidities and genetic factors who are dying. So in other words, people who are already sick are dying, which they would be doing anyway. The virus is a real threat for some. The power structure is exploiting it for sure, for some agenda that surely involves money and control, but this is not a mutually exclusive situation. It's an and or both situation. Just like climate change, it's real, but we're being lied to about our behavior causing it. The solar cycle is 95% of it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he said further, according to 2 geologists spoke to privately who did not consult each other, when I asked them separately, they said they can't speak out about climate change because it would be career suicide. Science is religion, and the carbon footprint. The carbon footprint is the original sin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're sinners. And I replied, I skipped all the climate change stuff because it's just not whatever. And I said, in my opinion, I've lost the order of these. I replied to that email. Much of it is flu shots. Why are people dying? Why are people sick? If they in fact are dying in excess numbers, particularly outside of institutions. One of the most serious problems with this whole thing is nearly everyone who is said to have died has died in a care home or a hospital. That's not a pandemic. If I were the district attorney and a lot of people had died in care homes and hospitals in my jurisdiction, I would be investigating that. I would not be accepting the claim that this is caused by a virus and is a pandemic, a thing that affects everyone. So my reply to him was, much of it's flu shots, pneumonia shots, both, if people are dying, both widely used in care facilities and hospitals, abuse of anti-COVID drugs, the use of ventilators and induced comas, same thing, pumped up 5G internet, and the pain of isolation from the lockdown. Those who are frail die fast when abandoned. So he's saying more people have died in this facility than in the past. And I'm saying that you can say that that's a virus, or you can actually investigate and find something out. And the history of virology is, in many respects, if you read this history, the history of chemicals, chemical exposure, malnutrition, and drugs, that is to say, sickness and death from chemical exposure, malnutrition, and drugs being blamed on a virus, then being found out to be about nutrition, chemical exposure, or drugs. This is what the known, documented, resolved cases say. Or, for example, in the case of polio, the correlation is overwhelming between the level of polio, which is now called flaccid myelitis, they changed the name, and DDT spraying. As DDT spraying goes down, the polio disappears. And though there would seem to be some kind of a polio virus, though I am really becoming a virus skeptic in terms of them causing disease, this whole theory is not established well enough to, for example, be like comparable to the theory of gravity. If I let go of the pen, it's going to fall on the desk. Chemical exposures over and over again are found to be the problem. Read Peter Duisberg's book on AIDS, and he begins the first 100 pages of the book explaining this from case to case to case over and over again, leading up to his discussion of AIDS, this acquired immune dysfunction syndrome. By the way, speaking of AIDS, I did an hour interview with Kevin Corbett on Planet Waves FM, a special video edition of Planet Waves FM. We have yet to publish that. I will add it to this program. Kevin was a nurse working in the first ever AIDS ward in England, sponsored by Diana, Princess of Wales. And so he had something like a decade of clinical experience and is therefore in no way a denialist. And then he pursued a PhD in the AIDS test. We've heard from him before. He's one of the 22 authors of the Corman-Drosten retraction demand. And I invited him back to talk about the parallels between the AIDS crisis and how the AIDS crisis became a template for the COVID crisis. Once you know the history, the actual history of the AIDS crisis, you can see that it is used as a template. AIDS virus does not exist. It was originally a leukemia virus, human T-cell leukemia virus type 3, which never caused leukemia, which didn't have a job, which was then said to cause AIDS with absolutely no proof. There is not one paper in existence proving that this virus causes this set of 29 diseases. And another situation where they try to convince us all that we were going to kill people by loving them. And I'm here to tell you, you are not a biohazard. And I would urge you to question this notion. When you put on a mask, if you do put on a mask, and if you believe it, if you don't just put it on to get a pizza, right? I mean, that's mostly why a lot of people put on the mask, right? They want to get the pizza, so they got to put on the mask to get the pizza. Because they won't let you in if you don't have the mask on. So-called mask, the schmata, I call it. You are affirming that you are a biohazard, that you must wear this thing to protect others. Of course, I don't think anyone really could be persuaded to do something to protect others, frankly. Maybe a little, but mostly people want to protect themselves. They want to save their own ass. How many people didn't go to Vietnam because they didn't want to kill a bunch of innocent North Vietnamese and Viet Cong? Or rather, because they didn't want to get killed. At the time, people who remember say, well, it was basically people saying, I don't want to go there and get shot. I don't want to go there and get my arm blown off or my legs blown off at 19 years old. I hate to say it, but people are mostly motivated by self-interest. And so this is another distortion of the will to good being turned toward self-interest. So anyway, to complete my dialogue with Charlie, I said average length of life in care homes is 5 months. In the U.S., from what I have read, there's been no statistically excess death most places, and where it was can be attributed to just medication and ventilation policy, i.e. there's a word for it, iatrogenic disease. Also, focus on something and it makes it seem like there is more of it. If you get a Volkswagen Jetta, suddenly you see them everywhere. Then there is the serious problem of psychogenic illness, which is real enough to be documented by the Department of Homeland Security in an internal policy newsletter, which I have read the contents of on this program. And while we're asking ourselves what is going on, we must remember that we are being persuaded fraudulently over and over again every day with this get the shot, get the vaccine, protect people, wear a mask, stay apart. Oh, the vaccine is going to save us. Oh, the vaccine doesn't stop the spread of anything. Oh, you still have to do this with the vaccine. This, by the way, this constant contradiction of message will screw your head up and will make you so confused as to hate yourself and not believe anything and not know what to think. I'm going to read again the summary of the Stanford study that finds masks ineffective, that, by the way, you cannot post to Facebook without getting blocked. I put it up. I didn't get banned from Facebook again, like I did a month ago when I said I would sooner shoot heroin in an alley with strangers than I would get one of these vaccines. I would risk some potential overdose or whatever, rather than risking something with the fucking up your ACE2 enzymes, which could cause all kinds of pulmonary issues and hypoxia and blood clotting and all this stuff, for which there's no off switch turning your body into a coronavirus factory. I mean, this is really serious. And I am sorry if you took this thing and now I am instilling anxiety. But the longer this goes on, the more problems are going to come out. And there is going to be a post-vaccination anxiety syndrome because people have taken it. They know there's no untaking it. You can't suck it out of your body. once it's in your cells. It's modified your genetic code. Your whole genetic system is adapting, following the instructions, and your entire body, every cell in your body, has been turned into a vaccine factory, an antigen factory. I can't imagine anybody who thinks about that can think it's a good idea. And if you're not being told that there's one or two people per 10,000, maybe, documented to be in the hospital, and you're being told there's a pandemic, because that's not a pandemic. One in 10,000 with hospitals empty, it's not a pandemic. It's fraud if you're being told that that's a pandemic. I'm going to read this Stanford study conclusion again. The existing scientific evidence challenges the safety and efficacy of wearing face masks as preventive intervention for COVID-19. The data suggest that both medical and non-medical face masks are ineffective to block human-to-human transmission of viral and infectious diseases such as SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19. Supporting against the usage of face masks, wearing face masks has been documented to have substantial adverse physiological and psychological effects. These include hypoxia, hypercapnia, which I don't know what that is, shortness of breath, increased acidity, toxicity, activation of fear and stress response, the rise in stress hormones, immunosuppression, fatigue, headaches, decline in cognitive performance, predisposition for viral and infectious illnesses, chronic stress, anxiety, and depression. Long-term consequences of wearing face masks can cause health deterioration, developing and progression of chronic diseases, and premature death. What problem don't they cause? They certainly don't cause the prevention of the community spread of a virus that's not proven to exist by any method of proof, and is largely every method of proof proves it's not there. If you believe in logic, if you think that maybe just like putting this all together, you see the obvious, or you just want to make people comfortable by wearing a mask, or you can't believe you fell for it, and therefore you're not going to change your position. Well, let me tell you something. I fell for it. I knew enough to not fall for it. And first part of 2020, watch my YouTube videos, I fell for it. I fell for it. I checked in with doctors, with a naturopath, MD, who I talked to, a client who I talked to in England, Suzette, with Gail Murphy, the midwife herbalist who I work with, and with others, homeopaths, Katie Bray, my homeopath. I did all the homeopathic research. I wrote about the homeopathic research that I did, explained about the remedies for respiratory illnesses. They're all connected to fear, but here's the thing. I stocked up on homeopathic remedies. I put up elderberry. I got a kind of a box of Paul Stamets, a Garrikon, which is supposed to be used by the Department of Defense to protect against germ warfare. I took it. My friend who was staying with me took it. I gave it to my dogs every night for months. And then I did my homework all during that. So I thought, all right, well, what's the worst that could happen? Maybe, this is not a vaccination. This is not anything I can't reverse. Mushrooms are mushrooms. They're not going to hurt me. Having a big bottle of elderberry is not going to hurt me. That's like the most potent elderberry tincture in human history. I have enough to share. I bought enough homeopathic remedies to essentially treat the entire town if I needed to, not knowing what was going to happen. And I did my homework. So it's not exactly like I believed it to the degree of shutting down my ability to think rationally. To the contrary, I thought, oh, I can take care of myself. I have the resources, I have the knowledge, I have the power to take care of myself and my community, canines included, without hurting anyone. Very important, right? This is, you don't want to hurt people with the cure. The cure can't be worse than the disease. Okay. Then I did my homework and I started with the test. And I stuck with the test, and I chased down every angle, up and down every street, probably 10 times. Up and down, back and forth, cross-checking, holding it open, living with the tension of the virus existing and not existing, living with the tension of the lab release versus the non-lab release. And then the thing that unraveled everything was I fully got to understand the test. And the one theory that I had at the beginning, my theory of the case at the beginning, was the stories in the test. I didn't know what story was in the test exactly. And this is, by the way, while I'm taking elderberry tincture. This is, by the way, while I'm following Susan Weed and listening to what she's saying. This is who thinks this is the worst thing ever and everybody's going to get it. Not believing what people were saying, but taking it under advisement and making sure that my precautionary approach in itself was not dangerous. And then I worked around the clock. I would have been very lonely without Cindy. Also working around the clock. And the rest of the XYZ list, who I didn't credit at the beginning of the show. There's a whole other Planet Wave staff, the XYZ list, who... I don't want to, if I say names, I'm going to miss them. So I don't want to, but you know who you are. Most of you listen. We would have been very lonely without the XYZ list, running this shit up and down the flagpole, back and forth, verifying everything, taking it apart and living with the tension of the multiple, I was calling it Schrödinger's virus because it exists at the same time it doesn't exist. It's caused by a lab at the same time it's not caused by a lab. But I pursued the theory that the test was the most important part of the story, which in a very complex situation, it's, I have found as an investigator, you got to pick the thing that you think is the most important thing. And I subspecialized cycle threshold issue. Everybody understands that. I thought, what's this reverse transcriptase issue? Anyway, when you get to the all the way to the bottom of the polymerase chain reaction, you find out that it can't test for a virus. You find out that the virus they claim to be testing for only exists in a computer, in silico virus, MN908947.2. One of the sequences released by China with no notes. You find out that there's no possible way it could have come from the Wuhan market. You find out that it's every... angle is a lie, but ultimately it comes back to the test, which can't test for a virus and which is using a, quote, mimicked human specimen, in the words of the CDC. This is fraud. And here's the thing about fraud. You are only a victim of fraud until you have the information needed to put the story together. At that point, the liability of the person committing the fraud essentially ceases from a legal standpoint once you have the information that you need to assemble the fact that you are being lied to. You are on notice. Your statute of limitations starts to toll from the moment you make the discovery. And everyone now has enough information to make the discovery. The problem is you have most people saying, well, I don't know shit, but you're wrong. You must be wrong because I have to protect my belief in what is not true. And if I accept that what I believed is not true, my entire house of cards that I think of as my mind, my intellect, my identity is going to collapse. Well, I say let it collapse. You don't need that mind. And if in the unlikely event, which I that you are someone who's thinking like this, we are confronted by a lot of people who do think like this, who are living in this state of essentially perpetual cognitive dissonance. The latest installation in my What I Learned When I Killed My Television, i.e. commercial television, I started exploring this thing called Great Courses on Amazon. A lot of times when I finish the day, I do not have the creative energy to do something like write or play guitar. So I relax by watching The Tube. Only what I found is that when that there's some one of my favorite things in the entire universe is contained in the back of Amazon, which is the Great Courses series, so I can watch university level lectures. So I went through like 50 physics lectures and like learned more than 50. A lot of these things, 25 classes in the series. So I think I watched three of those and watched several of them several times and kept playing them back. And then a couple of others, but then I saw one on the Black Death. There is a 26 lecture series. You got to check this out. And it's free if you have Amazon. Not that I like giving $15 a month to Bezos, but hell, if they're going to give me university level classes for 50 cents a day, well, if you go to Marist College or Bard College, that's all you're getting anyway. His video classes only for you. It's $75,000. 26 lecture series on the Black Death, which starts in 1378, I think. And what a disaster that wiped out 80% of some communities, believed to have wiped out half the world's population, with treatment something like, I don't know what they were doing to treat it, but said to have 90% survival if it was treated. But that's a plague. And in our case, it's a test result that is nothing. You're absolutely fine. And the devastation that this wrought, it completely rearranged society and was actually, in the end, very good for the little guy economically because it ends feudalism. It creates the concept of working wages. This is going on in the 14th century. Because now there were not enough people to prepare, you know, to sow the fields and harvest the grain and then smash the grain up, I forget what they call it, and then bake the bread. So people had to get paid. Wealthy people had to pay people to do this instead of just having it be done by serfs who were kind of slaves who are connected to the land. But the devastation of one's entire family dying in a week, I mean entire family, and being the only survivor, and they all end up buried in a mass grave and they're gone. Can you imagine? Along with half the rest of the town. And then towns, really evolved cities, burning down their entire business district, burning it to the ground. Jews being blamed. You know why? Because Jews have a holiday, Passover, where they clean their house. They throw out all their old grains, all gliding grains, wheat, rye, barley, oats, and spelt. Like, wow. You know, oats maybe not so much, but they can be contaminated. Throw out all the gliding grains. Scrub the place down. You don't have any rats. You don't have any rats. You don't have any fleas from rats in your house, which is what caused this thing. So they're thinking, Jews did it. Jews poisoned the well. Killed the Jews. Huh. That's what was going on. This complete devastation. And we are living this drama, this in silico drama. You are not a biohazard. Your children are not a biohazard. Your parents are not a biohazard. Your friends are not a biohazard. You are a person with a probably decently functioning immune system, and if it's not, there's ways that you can help yourself, even if you're not entirely well, even if you're pretty sick. Your body does its thing. But you're not a threat to other people, and you are being told over and over again, and I think this is the devastating loss of this, is this fomented distrust of everyone by everyone else. And that if you question, if you dare to trust, if you dare to breathe, you must be a killer. And that is an absolutely outright lie. and the authorities are perpetuating this lie. The song is called House of Cards.
Swear on me.
one of the most important things that we can remember about sexuality and sex at this time in history is that we are essentially crawling around and attempting to have relationships on the ruins of the AIDS disaster. The AIDS disaster was sold to the population as a sexually transmitted infection that was never once ever demonstrated to be such. It's one of those cases where it was about malnutrition, chemical toxins, drugs, and other related things. Essentially, lifestyle issues like starvation, overuse of antibiotics, massive chemical exposure, being called a virus. But I had not put that whole story together until it was explained to me in 2020, and I had the goods in 1992. When I finally had someone just show me the way the pieces fit together, which was Celia Farber, no less than the person who broke the story, who I met at her birthday party back during Leo time of 2020, I was stunned because I had it. So the devastation that this has wrought, however, the bigotry, the prejudice, the fear, the mistrust, is incalculable. And most people who are alive and sexually active today don't remember anything different because there was nothing, anything different pretty much occurred before 1990 or 1988, because it was at that time that the poison set in, and they were telling people over and over and over again, this is going to ravage heterosexual populations. You're all going to get it. We're all going to die. And this was in turn a response to what was viewed as too much freedom. Now, the people who shredded their immune systems on antibiotics, on a number of different sexual practices, like men douching and washing their immune system out of their intestines, which is where it is, the chemicals, the drugs, the antibiotics, there was a problem there. But it was a problem in a relatively small number of people that was then generalized out onto society. And so it is very difficult for us today to think about sexuality in any terms outside the context of AIDS. And we have to remember that. This is an outgrowth of another problem, which is that sexuality has, since the dawn of Christendom and Manichaeism, which I can never pronounce, which is essentially what Christianity is, the world is dark and light, and on the light side, essentially, are God and the sky and men, and on the dark, evil side are women, sex, and the ground, planet. And this philosophy, this prevailing, well, the structural wasn't prevailing. It was one of many philosophies, became the foundation of Christianity, has always put down women and sex and the earth and lumped them all into the same sinful, dirty, disgusting category. And this was going on during the time of the plague, by the way, where the one of the responses to the plague were self-flagellators who would go from town to town laying down in the shape of a cross, and then they would take turns whipping everyone, and then the next one would whip everyone, and they would whip themselves bloody day after day after day after day to assuage the God of the sins of all the people that were causing what would seem, by all accurate historical indications, as far as I can tell, to be a bacterial infection spread by fleas. So this is just the latest thing heaped onto centuries of the Christian anti-sex philosophy. And it is tempting to want things to be better, even though we have very little concept of better and very little concept, as one of my teachers pointed out, of what sex was like before all of this. So we have concepts of sacred sexuality that we think of as being maybe what it was like, and there are certain concepts of tantric practice which we think of as what it may have been like, but we don't really know, and we don't know for ourselves. We may know in some kind of theory, and as it turns out, our sexual relationships tend to be pretty fraught. Sex is very often used as a power tool. It is used as leverage against people in some way, and it is, I think, not conscious enough that this occurs and needs to be, and that on some level a great many people have had the thought that they need some form of sexual healing. But the question is, what is this thing? Where do you get it? What is it like? What qualifies someone to do it? How do you know the person's not merely taking advantage of you? Is it the Marvin Gaye song? Which just sounds like a night of good fucking, which, by the way, would qualify as sexual healing. You know, one of Betty Dodson's theories was, we've got to use pleasure, as she would call it, pleasure. Finally, she was coached to soften up her Kansas accent. Pleasure. You can hear it in the old videos. Use pleasure to be the thing that, the quality of the experience that we use for healing. Hold on. I have to turn off the tea kettle. It's humming along, not really screeching. I would be back in a digital instant. That tea kettle was an artifact of the miso kimchi soup that I made to have some peptone, to have this have some strength for this monologue here. It is getting a little late, but I have notes. That's going to help a lot. So what is this sexual healing thing? Well, first of all, I think that it must take place outside the context of romantic relationships, because there's way too much expectation and baggage when the paradigm is a romantic paradigm. I think any form of sexual healing requires the acknowledgement of the total independence of both people, that they are both there of their own free will, and then they get to continue to exercise that free will later the same day or the next day. So I think there cannot be the predisposition to jealousy that is so common in sexual situations, which is a form of concentrating or wielding power. And therefore, there must be another way for there to be sexual healing, for there to be a framework or context where this can be done. It is interesting that the sky is moving in the direction of Taurus, and in Taurus is 1992 QB1, now called Albion, which I have long associated with being a kind of an opposite of Pluto. Pluto is the you are death works and grow or die and enlightenment to the point of a gun type of thing, repenting at the last minute, whatever it might be. And QB1 to me says more about the gentle luring to the edge, the gentle luring to the space where some kind of learning, growth, healing, true surrender is possible. Okay, so I have a word for this, and that word is a thresholder. I've said it a number of times. I've written it a few times, and I have not really had the discipline to, develop the theory, develop the to focus the teaching And it exists simultaneously in a fictional form and in a real life form. And in the fictional form, in my, you know, fantasy sci-fi version of Book of Blue, thresholders are trained in midwifery, and they're trained in death midwifery, and they are trained in a kind of a very evolved and advanced orgasm coaching. We're going to find very few people who are trained in all of those forms of working with people at the edge of their reality, but that is the, let's say, the psychic template, the concept. And in reality, what I have found is that there are people who naturally gravitate toward this role of holding space for others to go through their transformational process and interfering as little as possible. There is a kind of an intervention involved, but the thing is that the person, I don't have a word for the person who's maybe the initiate, but we need a better word than that, because a lot of these words are, you know, way packed with meaning that does not apply here. But let's say for now, the initiate has to lead the way because it is their transmission, it's their journey, and the thresholder's role is, in a sense, to reflect and to be as neutral as possible, while providing what is necessary for the initiate, the thing that is necessary to, you know, give them what they need to have the experience that they need to have to be able to grow and learn and heal and let go in the way that they need to learn and grow and heal. And so the thresholder needs to be keenly sensitive to this, like a good astrologer, like a good therapist, like many other practitioners. Only the nature of the interaction is much more intimate because it's entering territory that is usually reserved only for either romantic partners or what today we call hookups, which in previous times was just called hanging out and having sex. And there is, of course, there is a taboo in the culture on healing practitioners having any form of sexual involvement with their clients. It's very serious. And so here we have a situation where the healing practitioner's role is specifically sexual. So we start to see exceptions to this in the case of certain forms of sex workers. In the case of, though, you know, Betty has, maybe there were some training specifically for orgasm coaches. I don't know of too many. Joseph Kramer, sometimes said to be the male Betty Dodson, though he does in many ways, you know, follow in her footsteps, did train a form of sexual body work that I believe in Sweden is licensed. And so it is considered a legitimate form of healing practice. I'm trying to get Joe on the program soon. He's kind of hard to get hold of. But I have the distinction of my writing about masturbation being the text material in Joe's training. And this is a great honor that someone with this level of knowledge and a pioneer of this whole modality felt that my writing about masturbation was worth being, and I believe the only text material on the topic of masturbation. He's been very encouraging, and our paths crossed maybe 22 years ago or so, and I've been in contact on and off over the decades with Joe. So I'm going to read from my notes, and maybe you'll recognize some of these ideas, and I will embellish slightly, maybe, you know, we'll see, I usually do when I'm reading. But here we go. So this is the subject header. It's an unsent email. And, well, I did send it to somebody named Kristen, who was interested in the subject, and I thought I would riff a little bit. Vesta creates, establishes, and holds space for a purpose. So let me say a little more about that. There is a principle of space holding and of the organization of space around a purpose. So this is from the concept of a hearth, where the hearth is generally the center of the home. The city fire creates the entrance to the city. Maybe there's a city fire in the center of the city. Maybe there's a fire in the center of the kiva. Humans like to organize themselves in circles around a fire. And this has a lot to do with Vesta, which is about the keeping of the flame. And the flame that Vesta keeps is the internal creative flame. It's represented in the outer world as a fire space, but the Vestal's role is to keep the fire burning. They have a number of other, you know, had traditionally in ancient Rome, had a number of other roles, but the most important of them was to not let the sacred fire go out. So you take that symbolically on any level that you want. QB1 brings the purpose. Thresholder, who is QB1, brings the theme and the approach. She serves, I'm going to use she throughout this, she serves many roles. Holding erotic space and heat is the center fire of those roles and of the purpose. In addition to offering an emotional container, the thresholder is skilled verbally at noticing and offering the things that, well, I'll use the word candor, desires or needs to hear instead of initiate. So this is, I forgot that I wrote this. It was not quite a channeling, but not quite not a channeling. In essence, you will repeat their confession back to them. This can offer transcendent pleasure soaked in a profound sense of beauty and relevance. For people to hear their own thoughts, needs, and desires affirmed verbally. Typically, sex happens without the conversation. It's crucial to notice this. And the conversation is difficult to sustain. It can seem embarrassing. Things are difficult to put into words. What makes sense in an altered state, altered by whatever possible means, may be very difficult to access in a normal waking state. However, I would say that a thresholder is able to work in any state of mind necessary, and so can do what they do in any state of mind. And the question of what state of mind the candor is in, I think that there is lots of room for experimentation with entheogenic substances that can soften the boundary of the ego and can melt off some of that seemingly very solid and brittle stuff. Okay, so repeating their confession back to them, this can offer transcendent pleasure soaked in a profound sense of beauty and relevance. So this is another thing. This is not. It is beauty and a very unusual kind of emotional exploration and satiation. But the thing about it is, it feels relevant. Like there's the sense of this is the thing necessary. Healing, pleasure, nourishment, surrender are facets of the same quality. Each equally evokes the others. The thresholder follows rather than leads, unless she is asked to take the voice or guide action. So this is still, you know, being led. Someone says, okay, this is what I need you to do. I need you to be strong. I need you to say these things. I need you to take over. That's still the candor giving permission to the thresholder. Experimentation with the candor helps give she a sense of what the candor wants or needs. So there's an experimental process. There's exploration. It's not done by a formula. Gravity is loosened up a little bit, and there's exploration. This is about following, so she follows in any event. Yet what guides the exploration is an entity of its own, which may feel like curiosity. So a lot of different things can drive the need for sexual experience. One of the things, or perhaps the most, that I think is the most useful, and in a sense the most it's not purist, but it's because that's a whole Catholic trip that there's some purity, but in a sense the most essential thing driving the need for sexual experience, I think, would be curiosity. It's a very important thing that what we call sentient beings have. And it's fascinating to see the curiosity of other critters. I, like, for example, love watching dogs and cats be curious and need to find out something. They just need to know what's up. So the need for verbal feedback is profound and is often withheld. Yet this truth is eschewed. It's avoided. Embarrassment seems to interfere. But embarrassment is also the invitation, if acknowledged. So working with embarrassment is a tool. And curiosity about the embarrassment is a way to, in a sense, penetrate the veil of the embarrassment and go toward whatever is there. So embarrassment seems to be a point of interference, but it's also an invitation, and especially if it's acknowledged. Spoken words evoke contact and understanding. Acknowledgement needs to be heard and received. The depth of healing from positive affirmation is of unknown beauty till it is experienced. So I think what a great many people really suffer from is the lack of approval. And I think that approval needs to be more than tacit approval. So the depth of healing from positive affirmation is of unknown beauty till it is experienced. The primary physical tool is the mirror in two forms, handheld and wall-mounted. Both are used to create the self-confrontation, engagement, or noticing. Where the mirror is in play, the candor is usually naked and the threshold is usually dressed. This may be vary depending on the scenario. So it's not a rule. It is just what might, be a starting point. But part of the dress is the boundary that the thresholder has in that they're not necessarily going to get too physically involved with the candor having the experience. Mirror play is often guided toward eyes open surrender facing one of the mirrors. So the idea is that the thresholder might in some way be a focus or object of desire, which can be very useful, but then that grants them a kind of power that is then used to guide the candor back to themselves. And so this is something that has to be done gently, and it takes practice. And in some ways, I find that it's a, well, it can be a less is more kind of a thing, and yet then there are going to be people who really want to be pushed, and so you have to listen to what the person is saying. Mirror play is often guided toward eyes open surrender, facing into one of the mirrors, i.e. mirror orgasm with witness. So the thresholder is a witness to this and helps inform and guide the experience. At the outset, the candor agrees to be led toward the mirror, toward self, and to gradually relax there in acceptance. The thresholder will ascertain the truth from the candor. In other words, get the person speaking. Use whatever power there is, whatever kind of can assist with submission. And there's certainly a power factor, but the question is how it is used. For example, the candor desiring the thresholder makes the person hot clay in the thresholder's hands. Then this becomes the lure to the edge, and the idea is to stay at the edge, get there, and to stay there for a while and explore the space at the threshold. That's why they're called thresholders. They work at the edge, and they bring the person to the edge and then stay there. And all kinds of things can come out of the conversation when you stay for a while at the edge, because the ego, the normal waking consciousness, continues to melt away. And then something else comes out. As the candor approaches the threshold, the psyche heats toward the melting point, or the khand, K-A-N-D. That's the word that came to me to describe this state. She, the thresholder, must be careful to determine whether and how the candor is prepared to melt. So, for example, it's possible to, in a sense, scorch people. So you want to do a little less rather than a little bit more, because there's probably going to be another experience. You can't always count on that, but I think this is a process that is best developed over time and as trust is developed. At least in my experience working with thresholders, the process evolving and developing over time is very helpful. If the candor asks to be melted, she may offer that. The thresholder may offer that, but doesn't have to. There's a kind of the need for a mutual understanding of what is right at that time, and the thresholder does have some prerogatives of what is right at that time. Signs of being at the melting point are suspension of judgment, suspension of jealousy, and no judgment around the mode of pleasure or surrender. For example, sexual orientation, preference, and taboo lose their negative power and just kind of melt into something that is connected to source. But because so many of these taboos and certain facets of orientation engender embarrassment, for example, any play around the surrender of heterosexuality in a heterosexually dominant person can do that, can lead to the possibility of going much deeper into a space connected to source. So they lose their kind of shame-inducing quality, but that shame can burn very, very hot and potentially very cleanly. And one author many years ago in The Mountain Astrologer pointed out a relationship between Vesta and shame, which I noted. This must have been around 2000 or so, and I've never found that article again. If you remember it, please let me know. If you wrote it, please let me know. But never didn't take the other step of understanding the role of guilt, shame, and embarrassment, that spectrum, which is probably deserving of a whole discussion. Being a thing to apply curiosity to, because so much of the pain is contained in shame, self-blame, embarrassment, and guilt. So much of what we're healing from are those things, and those things are also the byproducts of sexual abuse. They're the byproducts of rape. They're the byproducts of religiosity, and are a primary source of, fuel for the healing process. And it's interesting that with shame and embarrassment, that it becomes very efficient fuel for the healing process and feels really good when you get that reaction going, and then it might be gone. I mean, you might like consume the supply and then you miss it. And so there's that too is a takeoff point for another discussion. The thresholder helps deepen the experience for the candor and calls forth self-honesty through the use of the mirror and the voice. Self-love is composed of two qualities, self-honesty and self-trust. So, for example, the honesty with the thresholder and the trust of the thresholder is then guided by the thresholder into the mirror, and then the candor can be led to experience these feelings for themselves, and in the context of the witness, in the context of the person helping. And so, you know, this takes practice, but there are people who have a real knack for this, who just get it. I've probably met and worked with 50 different women over the years who just get it. A lot of them came through Book of Blue. A lot of them have been various shades of sex workers who've seen so much diversity of the need for healing, diversity of pain, diversity of experience and desire, and are used to being the projection screen for this. So we're completely inverting the sexual relationship by doing this. We're turning it completely inside out and then directing it to the self where it seems to want to go. There seems to be a kind of autotropism in a lot of eroticism, but then that there's a taboo on that and it's made to be guilty. And so what the thresholder is doing is working with that autotropism, that tropism for self-experience, and, as part of the, let's say, the gravitational force, which can push away, or magnetic force actually can push away as well as attract, so it's more magnetic than gravity, are using whatever energetic quality there is, whatever desire quality is in the relationship, and that goes right, reinvested right back into the candor having the experience. So, self-love is composed of two qualities, self-honesty and self-trust. And I would add to that self-forgiveness. So there can be a lot of space opened up around forgiveness and just hanging out there. It's forgiveness is not a thing like, I forgive you. It is a space of coexistence with oneself where the guilt dissipates into love and surrender and self-acceptance. And so your thresholder needs to be a very self-accepting person. Whatever the natural and inherent quality of the person may be, that self-acceptance is essential to the ability of a thresholder to do, to perform the service for the candor. Excuse me there. Okay. The thresholder is also aware of the witness of the dimensions, a presence that can manifest at the threshold and throughout the whole experience. But as the threshold is approached and draws near, there can be a sense of a kind of a pre-standing keeper of the gate. It may be an internal psychological facet of the candor. It may be an actual presence, maybe the Holy Spirit, Shekinah. And as it is said, the Holy Spirit is the indwelling feminine manifestation of God. So he's a Father, Son, Holy Spirit, the priest says as well. The feminine part of that is the Holy Spirit and is more easily and I think better identified as Shekinah. You can look it up. This is the exact same thing as the Holy Spirit, only it is Shakti in nature. So the thresholder is aware of this presence and works with this presence, invokes the presence, and can hold among the things the thresholder holds that presence. and this will presence will change as the threshold, as that melting point or that gateway draws near, and the threshold can guide the candor a little bit over toward the line, back over, but ultimately cannot go with the person, right? So it's not about ecstatic mutual orgasm. It's about guiding a person to be fully present for themselves. Imagine such a thing. Imagine the beauty of that. The threshold is also aware of the witness of the dimensions. Okay, I read that. Let's see. Presence that can manifest as the threshold is approached or draws near. This is a time when deep healing and self-alignment may be invited. Okay, and then I've got other ideas for further discussion. Preparation of the threshold, the meaning of she, and the celibacy or sharing status of the thresholder. Part of being a thresholder involves extended periods of not having sexual relations with others for the purpose of tuning themselves to their own inner reality. In different forms of when this becomes either a storyline or a training program in some way, like a actual manifest in some way, there I'll experiment with different versions of this. Right? What is the is the thresholder of a Vestal Virgin does not have sex with others? And what did the Vestal Virgins do when they were together? Could they masturbate together? Was that okay? Nobody has written this down. That I know of. So preparation of the threshold, or the meaning of she. What is this? And I think what I'm getting with that is it is Shekinah, the celibacy and or sharing status of the thresholder, and many other things, which are not written about in theoretical form in the Book of Blue, but are written about in experiential form in the Book of Blue. Though one of the things that that I do have and that I would be happy to share with anyone who writes to me is a series of theoretical teachings that I wrote and then presented using in silico voices, using sophisticated voice simulators, and then edited the voices into a kind of vibration to create in effect. If that is of any interest to you, you're invited to write to me at efc@bookofblue.com. I will know where to look for those emails. And what Book of Blue is, ultimately, is a photographic and journalistic document in pictures, writing, and audio of... really, this was getting underway in 2005. And so we're talking close to 15 years. There was some warm-up in 2004. I was living in Paris put ads in Craigslist and started photographing women in mirrors in a search for my own inner feminine, to align with my own inner feminine. And then many beautiful, interesting journeys emerged from that. Different lovers, entered the scenario, including, working with the models, as they were called. And many of those women I found were natural born thresholders and easily understood what this was about. There seems to be something archetypal here. This seems to be a discovery and not an invention. The reason the discovery is not made is that I have not really seen this discussed anywhere in the tantric literature. I have not seen it, not that I've read too much of it, but it's just never come up. I've never seen it come up at a tantric conference. I've never heard anyone speak about it. I think the closest is Betty's work, but the thing with Betty's work is it omits the verbal realm. There's the discussion at that close to that melting point, right at that kind of or Flashpoint is not, there isn't one. I've not, and I, you know, have discussed this a bazillion times with Betty, and I'm familiar with the process of the orgasm coaching process, and talked to other students who've been through it. And this is left out of that. This is a other thing entirely. And I think that it's somehow glossed over. And also I think that, there are not that many women confident enough to work with men, but I learned a lot from working with sex workers who have to be very confident working with men. One of the most important things I learned from sex workers is that there has to be total confidence. There is a friend who is my lover. Her name is Chakra. I don't know. That's not her name. I know, of course, her real name, because I, you know, hung out with her the summer that I was living in Vancouver, BC, who was becoming a sex worker while we were lovers. And that was really interesting. And so I've stayed, and I'm still in contact with her, you know, all these years later. This was the summer of, this goes way back before 2005 or four. I was with her the summer of 2000. Also met another tantric teacher named Roberta Sky. Learned a lot from Roberta Sky, but again, never encountered this particular teaching. So I still think that it's much more of a discovery than an invention, and can be developed, you know, from here. So anyway, if any of this intrigues you, please drop me a note, and I'm almost always open to a conversation about this, and to, you know, sharing, you know, what I have documented. I mean, I'm blessed to be a kind of a documentarian, and it's just the thing to do. And, you know, Book of Blue starts as photos. It starts as me documenting my quest for my inner woman. And then naturally I started writing about this and describing it. And then for a long time, like 8 years, the photos and the writing were happening at the same time. And there was some genuinely daring and beautiful, you know, photo projects, you know, created sometimes with two or three people, in the photo. And I can share those, you know, if I have, the model releases to do it. Almost all the sessions I have unconditional model releases. There's a couple I don't, but I know which ones they are. All right, that's what I have to offer you tonight. What I'm about to play for you, I think, is so beautiful. It's called Reckoner. It is from In Rainbows. It's the song that contains the phrase In Rainbows. And then I picked a Tom York solo piece because he's just so fucking awesome. Really, among musicians, I think the best my generation has had to offer. And I'm proud to be on the same planet as Tom York. So, and I don't feel so lonely as a writer when I've got somebody who can, like, blow me out of the water. And I'm like, ah, that's great. Okay. On that happy note, y'all know where to find me. I do not hide under a rock, nor do I hide my light under a bushel. Stay sane, please. Safe is free. Freedom is sanity. Breathe. Tell others, hello, I'm going to breathe now. Do not ask permission. Assert. Pranayama. Okay. Lots of love. And bye for now.
A self-fulfilling prophecy of endless possibility. You're rolling rings across the screen. In algebra, the fences that you can't climb, the sentences that do not rhyme. In all that you can never change, the one you're looking for, it gets you down. It gets you down. There's no spot.